Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Executive Power by Vince Flynn, narrated by George Guidel. This book is copyrighted 2003 by Vince Flynn. This recording is copyrighted 2003 by Recorded Books. Lauded as a hero, in the full glare of the public eye, Super Agent Mitch Rapp's cover has been blown. Happy to continue his counterterrorism efforts from behind a desk at CIA headquarters, he is brought back to the front line when a platoon of Navy SEALs is betrayed, caught in a deadly ambush with Islamic terrorists. The mission had been top secret. Who told the enemy? And now, Executive Power.
Prelude. The sleek gray craft sliced through the warm water and humid night air of the Philippine Sea at 25 knots, its twin engines rumbling toward its destination with a guttural moan. The boat was in violation of international law and at least one treaty, but the men on board didn't care. Technicalities, legalities, and diplomacy were for other people to sort out, people who sat in comfortable leather chairs with Ivy League degrees matted and framed on their office walls. The men standing on the deck of the Mark V Special Operations craft were here to get a job done, and in their minds it was a job that should have been taken care of months ago. The low-profile Mark V Special Operations craft was designed to sneak in under radar. It had been designed specifically for the United States Navy SEALs, and it was their choice of platform when running maritime insertions. It was 82 feet in length, but the boat only drafted 5 feet when it was fully loaded and dead in the water. Instead of the standard screw, it was propelled by 2 water jets. All of this allowed the boat to maneuver very close to the beach with great precision. 5 men, wearing black flight helmets and night vision goggles, manned 4 50-caliber machine guns and a 40-millimeter grenade launcher. 8 other men, dressed in jungle BDUs and floppy hats, sat on the gunwales of the rubber combat raiding craft they would soon launch off the Mark V and went over their equipment for at least the 10th time. Their faces were smeared with warlike green and black camouflage paint, but their expressions were calm. Lieutenant Jim DeVolis looked down at his SEAL squad and watched them go through their last check. He'd observed them doing it countless times before, and for some reason it always reminded him of baboons picking bugs from each other at the zoo. They meticulously examined their H-harnesses to make sure every snap was secure and all grenades taped. The communications gear was checked and rechecked. Fresh batteries had been placed in everyone's night vision goggles, and along with backup batteries, the expensive optical devices were stowed in waterproof pouches attached to their H-harnesses. Weapons were sandproofed, with condoms secured over the muzzles and a bead of silicone sealant around the magazines and bolt covers. The only person wearing a rucksack tonight would be the squad's medical corpsman, and DeVolis sincerely hoped they wouldn't be needing his expertise. The group was traveling light tonight, no MREs, only a couple of power bars for each man. The plan was to be in and out before the sun came up, just the way the SEALs liked it. The tension grew as they neared the demarcation point. DeVolis was glad to see that the jaw-jacking had subsided. It was time to get serious. Turning his head to the right and down, his lips found the tube for his neoprene camel water pack, and he sucked in a mouthful of fresh water. The men had been drinking all the water they could hold for 2 days. Hydration before an op in this part of the world was crucial. Even at night, the temperature was still in the mid-80s and the humidity wasn't far behind. The only thing that was keeping them from sweating through their BDUs was the breeze created by the boat as it cruised at 20-plus knots. Once they hit the beach, though, that would change. They had a 2-mile hike ahead of them through the thick tropical jungle, even with all the water they'd drunk in the last 2 days. Each man on the team would probably lose 5 to 10 pounds just hiking in and out. A firm hand fell on DeVolis's shoulder. He turned to look at the captain of the boat. 2 minutes out, Jim. Get your boys loaded up. DeVolis nodded once and blinked, his white eyes glowing bright against the dark camouflage paint spread across his face. "Thanks, Pat." The two men had practiced this drill hundreds of times back in Coronado, California, at the headquarters for Naval Special Warfare Group 1. "Don't go wandering off on me now," Davolis said with a wide grin. The captain smiled in the manner of someone who's confident in his professional ability. "If you call, I'll be there guns a-blazin'. That's what I like to hear." Davolis nodded and then turned to his men. With his forefinger pointed straight up, he made a circular motion, and the SEALs instantly got to their feet. A moment later, the boat slowed to just under 5 knots. The Mark V, in addition to being extremely fast, also came with a slanted aft deck that allowed it to launch and receive small craft without stopping. Without a word, the men grabbed the sides of their black CRRC with a 40-horsepower outboard leading and walked down the aft ramp. The men stopped at the end of the ramp, just shy of the Mark V's frothy white wake, and set the rubber boat on the non-skid deck, the lower unit of the outboard hanging in the water. A crew member from the Mark V held on to the rubber boat's bow line and looked for each man to give him a thumbs up. All 8 men were low in the boat, clutching their handholds. One by one, they returned the sign. The call came over the headset that the launch was a go, and the crewman tossed the bow line into the boat. A second crewman joined the first, and together they shoved the black rubber boat down the ramp and into the relatively warm water. The small rubber boat slowed instantly, the SEALs hanging as far to the aft as possible to prevent the bow from submarining. The boat rocked gently in the wake of the Mark V, and no one moved a muscle. The men lay perfectly still, listening to the ominous moan of the Mark V as it sped away. Not one of them had any desire for the boat to return until they needed it. They eagerly looked forward to carrying out their mission. Unfortunately, they were unaware that thousands of miles away, they'd already been fatally compromised by someone from their own country. Chapter 1. Anna Rielli drifted in and out of sleep, the warm sun enveloping her in a hazy dream. Her bronzed skin glistened with a mixture of sweat and sunscreen. A slight afternoon breeze floated in off the ocean. It had been the perfect week. Nothing but food, sun, sex, and sleep. The ideal honeymoon. A small resort on a remote Caribbean island with their own secluded cabana, gravity pool, and beach. Total privacy. No TV, no phones, no pagers. Just the two of them. She opened her eyes a touch and looked down at her wedding ring. She couldn't help but smile. She was like a schoolgirl again. It was a perfect diamond set in an elegant platinum Tiffany setting. Not too big, not too small, just right. Most important, though, it was from the right man. The man of her dreams. She was now officially Mrs. Anna Rapp. He had been a little surprised that she'd taken his name without so much as a word of debate. She was a feminist, after all, with definite liberal leanings, but she could also be an old-fashioned romantic. She could think of no other man she respected more. It was an honor to share his name, and she wanted the world to know that they were now a family. In addition, she could also be pragmatic. She had no desire to one day see her grandchildren running around with 4 last names. Professionally, though, she would keep her maiden name. As the White House correspondent for NBC, she already had name recognition and a solid career. It was a good compromise, and Mitch didn't object. Amazingly, the entire wedding had gone off without a hitch. Rielli couldn't think of a friend who didn't have at least one big blowout with her fiancé or mother-in-law while planning her wedding. For her part, Anna had always clung to the romantic notion that one day she'd fall in love and have a big wedding back at St. Anne's in Chicago. It was where her parents had been married, where she'd been baptized and confirmed, and where she and her brothers had gone to grade school. But in the months after they got engaged, she could see that this was an idea Mitch was less than enthusiastic about. It wasn't that he was uncooperative. He told her that if she wanted a big wedding back in Chicago, that is what they'd do. But she could feel his apprehension. He didn't have to state it. Mitch Rapp did not like being the center of attention. He was a man who was used to working behind the scenes. The strange truth was that her husband had been a covert operative for the CIA since the age of 22, and the harsh reality was that in some circles he was known as an assassin. In the months before their wedding, during the confirmation hearing for Mitch's boss at the CIA, a member of the House Intelligence Committee had leaked Mitch's story to the press in an attempt to derail Irene Kennedy's nomination as the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The president had come to both Rapp and Kennedy's defense, and a version of the truth was released to the media. The president told the story of how Rapp had led a team of commandos deep into Iraq to prevent Saddam Hussein from joining the nuclear club. The president called Rapp the single most important person in America's fight against terrorism, and overnight, the politicians lined up to shake his hand. Rapp had been thrust into the spotlight, and he didn't do well. Having survived for years because of his ability to move from city to city and country to country without being noticed, he was now recognized virtually everywhere he went. There were photographers and reporters who hounded him. Rapp tried to reason with them at first. A few listened, but most didn't. Not one to let a problem fester, Rapp arranged to have a few noses smashed. The others took the hint and backed off. There was something else, though, that worried Rapp a great deal. He was now a marked man. Virtually every terrorist from Jakarta to London knew who he was. Bounties had been placed on his head, and fatwas, Islamic religious decrees, had been thrown down by dozens of fanatical Muslim clerics across Arabia, Asia, and the Pacific Rim. Thousands, if not millions, of crazed Islamic zealots would gladly give their lives to take him down. Rapp worried incessantly about Anna's safety and had even asked her if she was sure she still wanted to spend the rest of her life looking over her shoulder. Without hesitation, she had said yes and told him not to insult her by bringing it up again. He had stoically honored her request, but it didn't stop his worrying. He had also taken some serious precautions, having ordered her a customized BMW with bulletproof glass, Kevlar-lined body, and shred-proof tires. They were also in the process of building a house on 20 acres outside D.C. in rural Virginia. Anna had asked more than once where the money came from to pay for all this, but Rapp had always deflected her questions with a joke or change of subject. She knew he was a man of many means, and in the end, she reasoned that there were some things she was better off not knowing. When they sat down to plan the wedding, Rapp brought up a laundry list of security concerns that would have to be addressed. As the weeks passed, Anna began to realize that he simply would not be able to enjoy the day if they held such a large wedding. She made the decision then to have a small private ceremony with their families and a few close friends. The news had been received well by Mitch. The event was held where they'd met, at the White House. Anna's entire family, her mom and dad, brothers and sisters-in-law, and seven nieces and nephews were there. Mitch's only surviving relative, his brother Stephen, was best man, while Anna's longtime friend Liz O'Rourke was the matron of honor. Dr. Irene Kennedy and a few of Rapp's friends from the CIA were present, as well as a select group of Anna's media friends. Father Malone from St. Anne's was flown in to officiate, and the President and the First Lady were the perfect hosts. President Hayes also used his significant clout to make sure there wasn't a mention of the wedding in any of the papers or on TV. It was agreed by all that it would be wise to keep the identity of Mrs. Mitch Rapp off the front pages. The guests all stayed at the Hay Adams Hotel, just a short walk across Lafayette Park from the White House. They celebrated well into the night, and then the bride and groom were taken by the Secret Service to Reagan National Airport, where they caught a private jet to their island. Courtesy of the CIA, they were traveling under the assumed identities of Troy and Betsy Harris. Anna sat up and looked over the edge of the patio down at the beach. Her husband was coming out of the water after a swim. Naturally dark-skinned, after a week in the sun he looked like he'd gone native. The man was a prime physical specimen, and she wasn't just thinking that because she was married to him. In his 20s, he'd been a world-class triathlete who competed in events around the world. He'd won the famous Iron Man competition in Hawaii twice. Now he was in his mid-30s and was still in great shape. Rapp sported some other physical features that had taken Riely a little getting used to. He had 3 visible bullet scars, 1 on his leg and 2 on his stomach. There was a 4th that was covered by a thick scar on his shoulder where the doctors had torn him open to get at the bullet and reconstruct his shoulder socket. There was an elongated knife scar on his right side and 1 last scar that he was particularly proud of. It was a constant reminder of the man he had sworn he would kill when he started on his crazy journey into the world of counterterrorism. It ran along the left side of his face, from his ear down to his jawline. The plastic surgeons had minimized the scar to a thin line, but more important to Rapp, the man who had marked him was now dead. Rapp stepped onto the patio, water dripping from his shorts, and smiled at his bride. "How you doing, honey?"
"Fine." She reached out her hand for him. "I was just dozing off a bit."
Rapp bent down and kissed her, and then without saying another word, he jumped into the small pool. He came up and rested his arms and chin on the edge. "Are you ready to go back tomorrow?" She shook her head and pouted prettily for him. Rapp smiled. She really made him happy. She was smart, funny, and drop-dead gorgeous. She could be a bit of a ballbuster at times, but he supposed any woman who was going to put up with him had to be able to assert herself, or it'd be only a matter of years before he screwed everything up. "Well, we'll just have to stay a little longer then," he said. She shook her head again and put the pouty lips back on. Reaching across the patio for the bucket of iced Red Stripe, he laughed to himself. He'd called her bluff. She needed to get back to work or the network would have a complete shit fit. If Rapp had it his way, she'd quit. The exposure was an ever-increasing risk to her safety, but Anna had to come to that conclusion on her own. He didn't want to wake up 10 years from now and have her go nuts on him for making her throw her career away. His only consolation was that her current assignment at the White House meant close proximity to more than 12 well-armed and supremely trained Secret Service agents and officers. "Would you like a beer, honey?"
"Sure."
Rapp opened one, handed the ice-cold bottle to Anna, and then opened one for himself. Reaching out with his bottle, he waited for his wife to do the same. The 2 bottles clinked together, and Rapp said, "To us."
"To us,"
she replied with a blissful smile. They both took a drink, and Rapp added, "And lots of cute, healthy babies." Anna laughed and held up 2 fingers. Rapp shook his head. "At least 5. She laughed even louder. "You're nuts." "I never said I wasn't." They sat there basking in the sun, talking about their future for the better part of an hour, teasing each other playfully about how many kids they were going to have, how they were going to be raised, what names they liked, and what they would do if one of the kids was as stubborn as either of them. Rapp refrained from sharing his opinion as she talked about what she would do with her job after they had a baby. It was one of those new things he'd learned about relationships. He understood that she was talking it out, and not looking for him to throw in his own 2 cents. For her part, Anna kept her promise that she would steer clear of digging for details on the goings-on at Langley. Rapp knew that if they were going to survive in the long run, he would have to share certain aspects of his job with her, regardless of what agency policy dictated. Anna was too curious to spend the rest of their lives never discussing what he spent the majority of the week doing. The general subjects of terrorism and national security were fair game, but anything involving specific intelligence or covert policy was off the table. Having been silent for so many years, Rapp actually found it satisfying to be able to share his opinions with someone who had a decent grasp of the issues. They opened 2 more beers, and Anna joined him in the water. They clung to the edge of the gravity pool and looked out at the ocean, their elbows and chins resting on the edge, their legs gently floating behind them. They laughed about the wedding and their week of seclusion and avoided mentioning that it was about to end. Rapp could tell that Anna was getting tipsy. She weighed only 115 pounds,
and the combination of beer, warm sun, and a lazy breeze meant a siesta was in the cards. After a little while, she kissed him on the lips and swam to the other end of the small pool. Climbing out, she stopped on the top step and pulled her hair into a loose ponytail. As she twisted it with both hands, the water cascaded down her smooth back and over her tiny white bikini bottom. With a flirtatious glance over her shoulder, she began to unhook her top. "I'm going to take a nap. Would you like to join me?" Keeping her back to him, she slipped off her bikini top and draped it over the hammock hook to her right. Needing no further encouragement, Rapp set his beer down and hoisted himself over the edge. He followed his wife into the bedroom, losing his swim trunks along the way. His eyes never left her body, and for a brief moment he found himself wishing they could stay on this tiny island forever. When they got back to Washington, it wouldn't be like this. There would be fires to be put out and plans to be put into action. He watched Anna slip out of her bikini bottom, and the problems awaiting him in Washington vanished. They could wait, at least for another day. Right now, he had more important things on his mind. Chapter 2. The black boat lay still in the water while Devolis took a quick fix with his handheld GPS. They were right on the mark, 2 miles off the coast of Dinagat Island in the Philippines. The men retrieved their night vision goggles, NVGs, from their waterproof pouches and secured them tightly on their heads. Thick clouds obscured the moon and the stars. Without the NVGs, they'd be blind. On Devolis's signal, the boat moved out, the modified Mercury outboard engine no louder than a hum. The powers that be in Washington had finally decided to make a move. Abu Sayyaf, a radical Muslim group operating in the Philippines, had kidnapped a family of Americans on vacation, the Andersons, from Portland, Oregon. The family, Mike and Judy, and their 3 children, Ava, 9, Charlie, 7, and Lola, 6, had been plucked from their seaside resort on the Philippine island of Samar 5 months earlier. Devolis and his men had followed the story closely, knowing that if the politicians ever got off their asses, it would most likely be their job to go in and rescue the Andersons. Devolis had spent a lot of nights thinking about the family, especially the kids. The 28-year-old officer wanted to rescue those kids more than anything else he'd wanted in his 6 years as a U.S. Navy SEAL. He'd stared at their pictures so often the edges were worn and brown, and read their files over and over until those innocent little faces visited him in his sleep. For better or worse, this mission had become personal. He wanted to be their savior. With Devolis, it was not false bravado, but an honestly and fiercely held conviction that someone needed to show these fanatics what happened when they screwed with the United States of America. Devolis was in no way sadistic, but he felt an unusual amount of hatred toward the men who were holding the Andersons. He couldn't grasp what type of person would kidnap innocent children, but whoever they were, Devolis felt confident that he would lose no sleep over whacking the whole lot of them. Tonight, Abu Sayyaf was going to feel the full force of the U.S. Navy, and the terrorist group would deeply regret having locked horns with the world's lone superpower. The USS Belleau Wood was lurking 15 miles off the coast of Dinagat Island. The Tarawa-class amphibious and air assault ship could bring to bear an immense amount of firepower. One of 5 such ships in the U.S. Navy's arsenal, the Belleau Wood was the Air Force, Army, and Navy rolled into one. She was a hybrid aircraft carrier and amphibious assault ship with an 800-foot flight deck. She carried 6 AV-8B Harrier attack jets, 4 AH-1W Super Cobra attack helicopters, and for troop transport, 12 CH-46 Sea Knight helicopters and 9 CH-53 Sea Stallion helicopters. The 250-foot well deck in the stern of the ship held the Navy's super-fast 135-foot cushioned LCAC, capable of delivering heavy equipment such as tanks and artillery to the beach at 40-plus knots. She carried a crew of 85 officers, 890 enlisted men and women, and a battalion of 2,000-plus Marines. The Belleau Wood provided true tactical integrity. Rather than waiting for various Air Force and Army units to come together to form an integrated fighting force, the Belleau Wood delivered a complete self-contained fighting unit to the hotspot with air power, muscle, and logistical support all at the same time. She was the culmination of everything the Marines and Navy had learned as they clawed their way across the Pacific during World War II. Devolis's squad was the advance element of the operation. Their job was to go in and recon the camp. Once they'd verified what the intel guys had told them, they were to set up a blocking position between the main opposing force and the hostages and call in the door kickers. Because of this, they'd left their suppressed MP5s back on the Belleau Wood, sacrificing stealth for firepower. Six of the eight men were carrying the M4 carbine, an undersized version of the venerable M16. With a shorter barrel and collapsible buttstock, the weapon was much easier to maneuver through the thick jungle. The squad's machine gunner was carrying an M249 SAW, and the sniper was carrying a customized, silenced, special-purpose rifle. When the shooting started, it would be very noisy, but for tonight's mission, this would be a plus. The noise created by Devolis's squad would both shock and disorient the opposing force as the helicopters swooped in from above and disgorged the assault teams. Three more squads of SEALs, 24 men total, would then fast rope in from above and both secure the hostages and sweep the camp. From there, the door kickers would move the Andersons one click from the camp to a small clearing for a helicopter evacuation. The clearing would be secured by a platoon of Force Recon Marines, and if things started to fall apart and they met more resistance than they'd planned, the Harrier attack jets and Super Cobra attack helicopters were on station for quick deployment. The squad would remain until the rescue element was safely out, and then work their way back to the beach and exfiltrate the same way they'd come in. A pretty straightforward plan, with one exception. They would be operating in the backyard of one of their allies, and the Filipinos weren't going to be involved in the operation. Not only were they not going to be involved, they weren't even going to be told it was going on. No one had told the SEALs why, but they had their suspicions. The Philippine Army had been promising for months to rescue the Andersons, and they hadn't done squat. There were rumors working their way around the teams that our old Pacific allies could no longer be trusted. So the United States was going to take care of things on its own. Devolis had learned early on in his career to steer clear of diplomatic and political questions. They tended to cloud the mission, which for a SEAL was a very bad thing. Mission clarity was crucial for a special forces officer. Besides, all that stuff was way above his pay grade. It was for the hoity-toity crowd with all their fancy titles and degrees. Despite knowing better, Devolis couldn't help but wonder how some of this might affect the mission. The scuttlebutt was that some pretty heated debates had taken place in Washington before they greenlighted the rescue operation. A rivulet of sweat dropped from his left eyebrow and landed on his cheek. He pressed the sleeve of his jungle BDU against his forehead and mopped his face. Silently he cursed the heat, knowing that if it was warm out here on the water, it would be completely soupy in the jungle. As they neared the beach, the boat slowed and settled in the calm water. There was only about 50 feet of sand between the waterline and the jungle. Every pair of eyes in the little rubber boat scanned the beach and the thick jungle in search of a sign that they weren't alone. Even with their night vision goggles, there was nothing much to glean beyond the empty beach. The jungle was too thick. Insertions were always a tense part of the op, but for tonight, at least, the intel guys had told him that it was highly doubtful they would meet any resistance upon landing. A large, mangled piece of driftwood sat at the water's edge. On Devolis's order, the boat headed in its direction. Unless it had moved since this morning's satellite photographs, that was their spot. Just to the right of it, and in from the beach approximately 100 yards, was a shallow stream they would use to work their way inland to the camp. The boat nudged onto the sand beach, just to the right of the driftwood.
The men moved with precision and speed. This was where they were most vulnerable, here on the beach, out in the open. They spread out in a predetermined formation that they'd practiced with numbing repetition. The lead men in the front of the boat maintained firing positions, while the others fanned out, creating a small, secure beachhead that provided 180 degrees of fire. Devolis lay in the prone position, slightly ahead of the others, the muzzle of his rifle pointed at his sector of the jungle, his heart beating a bit faster but under control. The goggles turned the dark night into a glowing green, white, and black landscape. Lying completely still, the lieutenant squinted his eyes in an attempt to pierce the wall of vegetation in front of him. After he'd given it a good look, he took his right finger off the trigger and pointed toward the jungle twice. 10 feet to Devolis's right, Scooter Mason, his point man, popped up and scampered off toward the jungle in a low crouch, his weapon at his shoulder ready to fire. Devolis took a second to check their flanks and looked down the beach in both directions. That was when it happened. A 3-round burst that shattered the still night, 3 loud, distinctive cracks that Devolis instantly knew came from a weapon that did not belong to any of his men. As Devolis swung his head around, he saw Scooter falling to the ground, and then the jungle in front of them erupted in a fusillade of gunfire. Bright muzzle flashes came from everywhere. A bullet whistled past the young lieutenant's head, and the sand in front of him began to dance as rounds thudded into the beach. In return, the squad let loose with everything they had. Each man hosed down his sector, focusing on the bright muzzle flashes of the enemy. Devolis unloaded his first 30-round magazine and ejected it. While fishing for a fresh magazine, he yelled into his lip mic, "Victor 5, this is Romeo. I need an immediate evac." Devolis rammed home the fresh magazine and chambered a round. A muzzle flash erupted at 1 o'clock, and he sent a 3-round burst right back down its throat. "Say again, Romeo," came the reply back over Devolis's earpiece. Devolis continued to fire and shouted, "We are taking heavy fire. We have at least one man down, and we need an immediate evac. Bring it right in on the beach." An earnest voice crackled back over the radio. "We're on the way." Devolis knew the rest of the team had heard his call for an evacuation over their headsets. They had covered it thoroughly in the pre-mission briefing. The Mark V was to circle back after it dropped them off and take up station 1.5 miles off the beach in case they were needed. It was a standard mission precaution, but one that no one thought they'd need tonight. As Devolis returned fire, he loudly cursed the people back in Washington. They'd walked right into an ambush, and for the life of him, he couldn't figure out how it had happened. "Guys, give me a sit rep by the numbers!" Devolis continued to fire while his men sounded off one by one. Only 5 men checked in. Devolis knew Scooter was down, and that left only one other. "Irv, talk to me!" Devolis repeated the request, then looked to his left. He could see Irv's prone figure, but there was no movement. "Listen up!" His shout was interrupted by several loud explosions as one of his men fired his M203 40mm grenade launcher into the jungle. "Gooch, put some smoke into their position. The boat will be here any second. When the big 50s start to rake the jungle, we move. I'll grab Irv. Gooch, can you get to Scooter?"
"Affirmative."
Devolis tore off his night vision goggles, reached for an M18 smoke grenade, and pulled the pin. Rolling onto one side, he lobbed the can of soup upwind from their position. The grenade rolled across the sand and began to hiss its white cover. Slowly, the fog worked its way back down the beach. Devolis knew the boat had to be near and started his crawl toward Irv. He had to get to him. No one could be left behind. When he was just a few feet away from his friend, a bullet found him. It slammed into his right leg. Through gritted teeth, Devolis let out a muffled scream and a slew of profanities. The pain had been so complete he wondered briefly if his leg had been blown off. He looked over his shoulder to reassure himself that it was still attached. He reached Irv just as the battle reached a new crescendo. The big 50-caliber machine guns of the Mark V tore into the jungle with vicious force. Shredded leaves rained down, branches snapped free, trunks absorbed the big rounds with cracking moans and thuds, and then the 40-millimeter grenade launcher let loose with a salvo of explosions. The enemy's guns all but stopped as they dove for cover. Devolis called out his friend's name and reached out for his shoulder. When he turned him over, all he saw was a lifeless face, staring blankly at the night sky, his jaw open and loose. A bullet had struck him in the forehead. and a mixture of sand and blood covered one side of his face. Devolus froze briefly in sorrow as the finality of the moment hit home, and then a line of bullets popped in the sand just in front of him. A voice inside told him to get to the water. Now was not the time to mourn his friend's death. Devolus grabbed Irv's H-harness and began dragging him toward the safety of the sea. As he struggled with a lifeless body and only one good leg, he called for his team to report in. While they did, he reached the warm, salty water and looked over at the rubber raft. It was too shot up to bother recovering. He continued to move away from the shore, pulling his friend with him as the salt water began to bite at the bullet hole in his leg. He gave the team orders to abandon the raft and swim out for pickup. Devolus stopped in about 5 feet of water and waited for each team member to pass. The Mark V continued to rake the beach with its big 50-caliber machine guns until the enemy fire was reduced to a few sporadic shots. Devolus side-stroked with all his might, clutching his dead friend as they moved farther and farther away from the shore. As he neared the safety of the boat, he blocked out the agonizing pain and tried to understand how they could possibly have walked into an ambush. Chapter 3. The man sat on the back seat of a power launch, his oil-black hair blowing in the wind like a lion's mane as the boat sped away from the Monte Carlo dock. The sun was climbing into the bright blue Mediterranean sky. It looked to be another perfect day in the playland of the ultra-rich. The passenger's dark skin was offset by a loose-fitting white shirt and a pair of black Ray-Ban sunglasses. He looked like something out of a travel magazine, with his arms stretched across the back of the white leather seat and the sun shining down on his chiseled face, a postcard, if you will, for how to get away from the everyday grind of life. For the passenger sitting in the back of the launch, however, this little sojourn out to sea would be anything but relaxing. He was not getting away from the everyday grind. He was heading directly into it. He was on his way to pay a visit to a man he disliked intensely. And to make matters worse, the visit was not his idea. It was a command performance. The handsome man went by the name of David. No last name, just David. It wasn't his real name, but one that he had adopted years ago while he'd attended university in America. It was a name that suited him well in a profession that called for striking just the right balance between anonymity and panache. David was a survivor. He had grown up in an environment that bred violence and hatred, and had somehow managed to master both at an early age. Controlling his emotions instead of being driven by them was what allowed David to pick his way through the minefield of his youth and set a course for greatness. And now, at the relatively young age of 34, he was poised to change the world. If only the man he was going to see would leave him alone, he could put the final pieces of his plan into place. David looked over the windscreen of the launch at the massive yacht anchored out at the far environs of the harbor, and sighed. In David's mind, the yacht and its owner were almost indistinguishable. Both were huge. Both demanded to be noticed by all who slipped into their sphere, and both needed a crew of tireless workers to keep them afloat. There were days when David wondered if he could turn back the clock and start over. Would he have chosen someone else to be his benefactor? He traveled a great deal, and in his line of work, if you could call it that, taking notes was a very bad idea, so he constantly mulled over his previous decisions and how they would affect his next move. Every flight and train ride was an endless scrolling through of what-ifs and whos. At some point, though, it was all moot. He was too far into it now to change horses. Prince Omar was his partner, and at the end of the day David had to begrudgingly admit that the man had held up his end of the bargain, at least financially. As the ostentatious yacht loomed larger with each passing second, David once again had the uneasy sensation that he was being pulled into the prince's orbit against his wishes. The man was like an illicit drug. In small doses he was tempting and beguiling, but if not monitored, His excesses could rot your body and your soul to the core. As the launch pulled up alongside the massive 315-foot yacht, the sun was blocked out, its warmth dissipating in the cool morning air. David glanced down and noticed goosebumps on his arm. He hoped this was merely a result of the change in temperature and not an omen of bad things to come. The prince had requested that David join him for lunch and drinks at 2 that afternoon, but David wasn't about to waste an entire day in Monaco. There was far too much to be done. The prince would not be happy, but at this point in the game, there wasn't a lot he could do other than stamp his feet in protest. Before the launch came to a stop, David shoved €100 into the driver's shirt pocket and leaped onto the stern deck. He landed gracefully and immediately noticed 5 white garbage bags filled with the waste from last night's party. Even in the cool morning air, he could smell wine and beer and God knows what else leaking from the bags. The prince would be in rough shape. A voice sounded from somewhere above. "You're early." David recognized the French-accented English of the prince's chief minion and said, "Sorry, Devon." Looking up, he saw the prince's assistant, Devon Leclerc, and next to him, the prince's ever-present Chinese bodyguard, Chung. Devon looked down at him with an irritated frown. "You're going to have to wait, you know." David started up the ladder, keeping his eye on Devon. Dressed in a suit and holding his leather-encased Palm Pilot, he looked more like a cruise director than quite possibly the highest-paid executive assistant in the world. David smiled and said, "You're looking well this morning, Devon." He clapped the prince's assistant on the shoulder and added, "I trust you didn't take part in last night's activities." With a dramatic roll of the eyes, Devon replied, "Never. Someone has to stay sober enough to make sure this enterprise stays afloat." True enough. David almost asked how the party went and then thought better of it. If he hung around long enough, the prince would probably force him to sit through a private viewing of the debauchery that had most certainly been recorded for posterity. "Will you be staying with us long?" The prince's assistant had his pen poised over his now open Palm Pilot, ready to go to work. "No, I'm sorry." David always treated Devon with great respect and care. As the gatekeeper to the prince, he was someone you wanted on your side. "Well, you are going to have to wait quite a while for His Highness to awake. The sun was starting to come up when he finally called it a night." David pushed his sunglasses onto the top of his head and checked his Rolex. It was 9:15. "Devon, I'm sorry, but I can't wait. He ordered me to show up today, and to be truthful, I didn't even have time for that." He leaned in and lowered his voice. "I really can't afford to sit around all day and wait for him to sleep off last night's hangover." The thin Frenchman closed his Palm Pilot and looked at David pensively through his silver-rimmed oval spectacles.
"He will not be happy."
"I know he won't, and you can blame it all on me." David could see Devon was on the fence. "If you would like, I will go wake him up, but I absolutely can't afford to waste the day away waiting for him." He watched as Devon's eyes quickly scanned him from head to toe, and then looked over at Chung, who shook his head. There was no way the man charged with keeping the prince alive was going to let this particular guest enter the prince's inner sanctum unannounced, for David was a man with many talents. As he turned to go, the ever-efficient assistant said,
"I will see what I can do. In the meantime, are you hungry?"
"Yes."
Pointing up, he said, "I will have breakfast prepared for you on the aft sun deck."
With a curt nod, the assistant turned and disappeared into the ship, leaving David and Chung alone with one of their uncomfortable moments of silence, the assassin and the bodyguard. Chapter 4. A small table lamp was the only illumination in the large corner office of the building. It was past 10 in the evening, and all but a few of the thousands of bureaucrats who toiled there had gone home. The black-clad security staff patrolled the hallways and the woods outside, as they did 24 hours a day every day of the year. There were no holidays in the business of protecting secrets. for the woman charged with protecting those secrets and stealing those of her adversaries, it was a never-ending circle of suspicion. On this particular night, an unshakable sense of foreboding enveloped her as she looked out over the dark landscape that surrounded the massive office complex. Nightfall had crept across the countryside, bringing to a close another day, and with it, more worries. She sat in her office on the top floor of one of the world's most notorious organizations and pondered a multitude of potential threats. They were not imaginary, exaggerated, or petty. Dr. Irene Kennedy knew better than anyone the lethal nature of her foe. She had seen it with her own eyes. She had watched the tide of fanaticism swell over the last 30 years, watched it roll toward America's shores like an increasingly ominous storm. She had been Churchillian in her warnings about the growing threat, but her dire predictions had fallen on deaf ears. The people she answered to were infinitely more concerned with the issues that dominate the political discourse of a peacetime democracy. No one wanted to deal with or even hear about an apocalyptic threat. They were more concerned with triangulating issues and with weakening their opponents through real or imagined scandals. She was even called an alarmist by some, but through it all, she stayed the course. It was an irony that didn't sit well with her that many of the same senators and congressmen who labeled her an alarmist were the same ones who were now calling for her resignation. Some had even suggested that the CIA should be put out to pasture like some old plow horse that had served its purpose but was no longer capable of doing its job. The storm that she had predicted, however, was upon them, and the professional politicians who had ignored her warnings and frustrated her actions at every turn were not about to take an ounce of the blame. This unique breed of human was utterly incapable of accepting responsibility for any past mistakes, unless they wrapped it first in a well-timed act of contrition that would gain them sympathy. Fortunately for Kennedy, there were a few honorable senators and congressmen on the Hill who shared her commitment and concern. These were men and women who had been with her every step of the way as she attempted to change policies and operational procedures in order to prepare for the coming threat. They and the president had come to her defense and stymied a plan to have her removed as the director of the CIA. Now, it was time to play catch-up. In the glow of the desk lamp, Dr. Irene Kennedy looked down at the transcripts before her and was sickened by what she read. It wasn't in her personality to get angry. She had divorced intellect from emotion a long time ago. She was simply pained. Men had died. Good men with families and children and mothers and fathers. And they had died because people who should know better couldn't grasp the importance of operational security. Even worse, they couldn't even keep a simple secret for just 24 hours. Even after September 11th, they lacked the commitment to protect their country. People simply didn't understand how serious the task before them was. Intelligent, educated people put the politics of their various agencies before operational security, and because of it, two men were dead. An entire operation involving hundreds of soldiers, marines, aviators, airmen, and sailors was called off, and a family of innocent Americans were still trapped in a hell that no adult, let alone child, should have to suffer through. The entire episode was a monumental security failure, and Kennedy had decided enough was enough. She would not lose her cool and begin screaming for people's scalps. That was not the way she'd been taught to perform her duties. She had been trained by one of the best. Thomas Stansfield, the now deceased director of the CIA, was fond of saying that a master spy should be a closed book unless it wished to be opened. A day did not pass that his advice went unheeded. Before her were two red folders. The one on her left consisted of email intercepts between a high-ranking State Department official and an overseas ambassador. It also contained some transcripts of phone conversations and other intelligence data. The folder on the right was much thicker.
It contained bank records from the last several years for a variety of accounts spread around the Pacific, an in-depth biography of the person in question, and satellite images and intercepts. Both folders held clear and convincing evidence that certain individuals at home and abroad were guilty of compromising the hostage rescue in the Philippines. In years past, this was the type of information the CIA would have quietly disseminated to a few select individuals around Washington. Since no administration liked scandal, that's where it would have ended. A few wrists would have been slapped. Some people might have been reassigned to less desirable posts or asked to retire early or find a job in the private sector, but rarely was anyone really made an example of. This time, it would be different. Kennedy was adamant about what needed to be done. The file on her left was going to be handled very publicly. When the press found out, the two bureaucrats involved were going to get a non-lethal dose of what those SEALs faced when they hit the beach over in the Philippines. They would be met with a landslide of lights and cameras, and where the cameras were in Washington, you could always count on politicians to show up. As Kennedy looked out the window, she knew which senators and congressmen would take to the airwaves. There were a handful from each party that couldn't resist. Their vanity made it impossible for them to ever pass up an opportunity to show their faces to millions of potential voters. There were a few others who knew TV time meant increased campaign contributions, and increased contributions meant re-election. Within those two groups, there were those who would try to blame the president, there were those who would try to blame the previous president, and there were those who would try to blame the State Department for being a bastion of lefties who cared more about the UN than the national security of America. There were also those who would demand justice, when justice was the furthest thing from what they wanted. And finally, there were those who would demand justice and really mean it. All of this would be a sideshow to the main event, though. What Kennedy really wanted to do was remind everyone in Washington with the security clearance that this was serious business. It was not up to any given individual to decide what secrets they could and couldn't discuss. These were not just bureaucratic rules, they were laws. And to break those laws would mean public embarrassment, prosecution, and if a judge and jury saw fit, jail time. The other file was going to be handled more subtly and in a much more final way. Kennedy knew just the man to take care of both problems. She had been tempted to recall him from his honeymoon, but decided it could wait another 24 hours. Things were about to change in Washington, and Mitch Rapp was going to play a crucial role. Kennedy knew Rapp better than anyone. She had recruited him, she oversaw his training, and she had been his handler through the most stressful of times and delicate of situations. Over the years, she had grown to love him like a brother. His sense of commitment and honor was of the highest order. When he got back from his honeymoon and found out what had happened, he would need no direction, no prodding, no explanation of the bigger picture. The only thing he might need was restraint. And Kennedy had yet to decide if she would even attempt to calm him when he heard the news. There would be those at the White House who would want to keep this entire mess out of the papers. They would want to sweep it under the rug and have the offenders in question transferred to different jobs. That could not be allowed to happen this time. And Kennedy knew Rapp was the one man in Washington who would tell the president in the roughest and most graphic terms that heads needed to roll. Chapter 5. David took a sip of orange juice and looked out upon the vista of Monte Carlo. It was a place of serene beauty, with the warm sun beating down on him and the peaceful sounds of the harbor. He could almost allow himself to fall asleep, but there was too much to be done. He checked his watch. In front of him only a few scraps of his exquisite breakfast remained. The prince had a team of chefs that accompanied him wherever he traveled.
It had been 30 minutes since Devon had left to awaken the large one, and although David did not expect the prince to bound out of bed and come meet him, he truly wasn't going to wait around all day. The prince had summoned him in the midst of the final stages of preparation for their grand plan. And for that, David was not going to leave without exacting a heavy fee from his benefactor. Despite his irritation at the interruption, it was time that if they were going to discuss business, it was better to do it in person. Conducting such matters over the phone was always risky. One never really knew what the Americans could pick up with all those damn satellites of theirs. David had many talents, but there was one area in particular where he was exceptionally gifted. It was getting wealthy people to part with their money. The key, David had learned, was to show them a return on their initial investment. He'd perfected that skill while working for a small venture capital firm in Silicon Valley after he'd graduated from the University of California at Berkeley. David had specialized in bringing in wealthy Saudi oil money, and that was how he had met the man whose boat he was now on. He felt the prince before he actually heard him. A slight tremor rumbled across the deck, and tiny ripples spread across the surface of his water glass. David looked over his shoulder just in time to see the large one step through the glass sliding door and onto the covered part of the sun deck. The prince's ring-studded hand protected his eyes from the offending light of day. In Arabic, he yelled a command, and instantly a man appeared at his side with a gold tray and a pair of sunglasses placed perfectly in the middle. The prince snatched them and somehow managed to squeeze them onto his fat head. Looking at David sitting in the sun, Prince Omar began shaking one of his beefy fingers at him and cursing him in his native Arab tongue. David stifled a smile and apologized effusively for interrupting the prince's sleep. Switching over to English, he said, "You know, Your Highness, that I would not have interrupted you if it were not important." Rather than come out into the sun, Prince Omar plopped his ample body down on a large couch overflowing with pillows. Chung, the mountainous bodyguard, took up his post on the other side of the sun deck so he could both keep an eye on things and stay out of the way of the servants who constantly buzzed about the prince. After adjusting his white silk robe, Omar began stuffing and throwing pillows about until his fleshy body was supported just right. David watched all of this with amusement. He had seen photographs of the prince in his younger years. Omar had once been a handsome and slender man. He had been an international playboy. One of the world's wealthiest men, he jetted from one continent to the next, always attending the best parties. Now, in his early 50s, he was a gluttonous wreck. All of the hard years had finally caught up with him. After his 50th birthday, he entered a downward spiral of depression, sparked by the realization that the party would not go on forever. With his depression came great mood swings and a seemingly insatiable thirst for a plethora of vices. Three servants in crisp white tunics and black pants stepped onto the sun deck and formed a conga line just to the side of the prince. They all held gold trays overflowing with various things the prince might desire. Just serving the prince was not enough. These men were to predict his needs so that when the prince decided he wanted something, it appeared as if they had anticipated his every whim. The first servant presented a tray with cigarettes. Omar snatched one, and the servant held a diamond-studded gold lighter to it. When the cigarette was lit, the man bowed and peeled away, only to be instantly replaced by the second man, who held a tray of drinks for the prince to choose from. There was an orange one, a red one, a pink one, and even a blue one, and all of them were perfectly garnished with skewers of fruit or vegetables. Omar's bejeweled fingers danced above the glasses while his tongue tried to decide which one it wanted. He picked the pink one, took a sip, and then put it back with a sour expression on his face. Quickly, he zeroed in on the red one, which David assumed was a Bloody Mary. After taking a long sip through the straw, he waved the servant away and stared at David for a long moment.
Prince Omar admired the Palestinian. He had guts, he had brains, and he was dashingly handsome. If anyone other than one of his family members had just awakened him, he would have told Devon to have Chung throw them into the sea. In fact, now that he thought about it, there were several family members he'd like to have thrown into the sea anyway, and they hadn't even interrupted his sleep. Omar finally said,
"David, come. Tell me why you are in such a hurry."
The third servant appeared at the prince's side, holding a tray overflowing with pastries. Omar gestured for the tray to be placed on the table before him. David walked across the sun deck and stepped under the canvas awning. He sat in a chair across from the prince and watched him devour a pastry with some type of cream filling.
"Why do you wish to irritate me like this, my friend?" asked the prince.
A Cheshire Cat grin spread across David's lips. He knew the prince liked him for the very reason he was scolding him. When you spend your every waking moment surrounded by sycophants, it can be refreshing to be treated with a little insolence.
"Your Highness, I am almost ready to implement your plan."
David referred to it as the prince's plan, even though it was his own. "There are many things to be done, and as we've discussed, there is little room for error." The prince set his drink down and shifted forward in anticipation.
"How close are we?"
"Close."
"Close," repeated the prince with irritation in his voice. "Don't tell me close. I want details."
"You have all the details you need, my prince," David replied in an even voice. The prince struggled in his sea of pillows to straighten up and in frustration barked,
"Do I need to remind you who you are speaking with?"
Casually, David took off his sunglasses and placed them in his breast pocket. "I will never forget what you have done for me and my people, my prince. You are one of the few who truly care, and among those few, you are the greatest of our heroes. But we have been through this before, and for your own good there are certain things you are better off not knowing." The seemingly heartfelt homage appeared to calm Omar for the moment.
"Come, sit by me and whisper these things in my ear. I release you of your worries. I will decide what I am better off not knowing."
David did not move. "My prince, once I tell you, there is no taking it back. If things go wrong, you could be implicated."
"I thought you were taking care of that."
"I am. And that is why I cannot stay here today and enjoy your gracious hospitality. I need to get to Amman for a meeting that will throw the dogs off your trail if things don't go the way we've planned." Omar plucked another pastry from the mound and took a large bite. With a red filling oozing from the corners of his mouth, he asked in a quiet voice,
"When will it start?"
While David pondered how much he should tell him, a servant stepped forward and handed the prince a steaming white hand towel. The prince cleaned his lips and jet-black goatee and then tossed the towel to the deck. David watched the servant pick it up and then said, "The action will start very soon, my prince."
"How soon?"
Omar asked eagerly.
"Soon." "Within the month?"
David shook his head.
"Sooner." "In weeks?"
Smiling just slightly, he answered, "Within the week, my prince." The prince clapped his hands together and nodded enthusiastically.
"This is good news. This is wonderful."
As the prince reveled in the news, a nubile young woman with flowing blonde hair stepped onto the deck wearing only a sheer robe. She approached the prince and ran her fingers through his hair. In French, she asked him why he had left her. Omar pushed her away, telling her to go lounge in the sun until he was done. The woman stuck out her lower lip and walked past David, giving him a flirtatious wink. The prince watched her with great interest and said,
"David, turn around and look at her. She is perfect."
David looked over his shoulder just as the statuesque woman undid her robe and let it fall to the floor. The view was not bad.
A pair of white thong panties were all that she wore. David admired her curves as she raised her hands above her head and stretched. Turning back to the prince, he smiled and said, "Very nice." Omar had a lascivious grin on his face.
"There is another one just like her. If you stay tonight, you can have them both."
"Yeah, and I'll bet you'll tape the whole thing," David thought. In addition to a fetish for taping his visitors, there were other things that worried him even more about the prince. But he did not want to dredge all that up right now. "Your offer is very kind, but I have too much to do. And besides, I need to keep my mind clear." The prince nodded knowingly.
"When you are done, then, I will present them to you as a gift."
David smiled graciously, but didn't say what he was thinking. That he would prefer to find his own women. Women who didn't need to be paid. Women who hadn't been defiled by the prince's diseased sex organ. Getting back to more important matters, he said, "There is something you could do for me at present."
"And would that have anything to do with money?" asked Omar with a stern look.
Not the least bit embarrassed, David replied, "Of course. You know how things are among our Arab brothers. As long as they get paid, they are happy."
"What about the cause?" snapped the prince. "Isn't that enough?"
"For a select few, yes. The martyrs and the true believers, but they are not the type we want involved in this. As I've told you, we need professionals, not people who will simply blow themselves up."
"But I thought you said the martyrs are part of your plan."
"They are," answered David in a slightly irritated voice. "They will act like livestock spooked by a fire. They will be driven into action by rage, not by any orders that I give them." Omar thought about this for a moment and then asked,
"How much more do you need?"
David held up all his fingers, and for the first time in all his negotiations with the prince, he knew he would get exactly that much and not a penny less.
10 million,
scoffed the prince. He began shaking one of his chubby fingers in the Palestinian's direction.
"You have become far too greedy."
The prince was a billionaire many times over. Easily one of the 100 richest men in the world. 10 million was a pittance. But it was still the most David had ever asked for in a single sitting.
"My prince, you are a man who understands value. My services do not come cheaply. And what I am about to embark on for you and my people will change the course of history."
5 million. David stood and joined the prince on the couch. With a sideways glance, he noticed Chung moving closer in case he was needed. In a hushed voice, David said, "Prince Omar, what is the one thing in this whole world you would take the most pleasure in?" The prince's eyes lit up at the question, and David could tell he was going through a lengthy list. "My prince, think of the subject at hand. What we are about to embark on." Omar smiled with a hateful lust in his eyes.
"To see Israel destroyed."
"Exactly, my prince. $10 million is a pittance. And for it, I will give you a front row seat to the self-destruction of the Zionist state." Omar grabbed David's hand and squeezed it.
"Half now, and half when you are done. Tell Devon where you want the money wired, and it will be done. Now, be on your way. And give me the gift I have waited a lifetime for."
Chapter 6. The silver-haired gentleman appeared to have his nose buried in the European edition of the London Times. A soft breeze blew across the water, seagulls played above, and the lines slapped out their rhythmic notes on the tall mast of the sailboat. To all outward appearances, Alan Church looked to be enjoying retirement. First observations with such a man, though, were always a bit tricky. The 71-year-old Brit had spent the majority of his years trying to give people the right first impression, or the wrong one, depending on how you looked at it. Alan was a mechanical engineer by training, but even that was only half true. He spent his 20s and 30s working for a large British energy conglomerate, and again, this was only part of the story. During that time, he traveled to the world's smaller and poorer nations in an effort to bring them hydroelectric power. It seemed for those 2 decades that Alan could be found wherever things were the nastiest, usually in a country where the transition from one ruling group to another was taking place, and not in a peaceful, democratic way. Most of those halcyon days, as he now somewhat sarcastically called them, were spent on the continent of Africa. In truth, his time on the Dark Continent was anything but tranquil. He was robbed, shot at, kidnapped, twice caught malaria, and once caught yellow fever. It was after the second bout of malaria that the powers back in London decided that it was time for Alan to take a new job in international finance. He'd spilled blood and toiled for the Crown, or, more precisely, Her Majesty's Secret Service, for almost 2 decades. He was placed, without having to interview for the position, at one of Britain's finest banks, where he eventually ended up keeping an eye on the financial comings and goings of the House of Saud. Officially or unofficially, depending on how you looked at it, Alan Church never worked for MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service. To this day, if someone asked him the question, he would laugh heartily and begin telling over-the-top tales of all the female spies he'd boffed in the service of the Crown. People who really knew him well, which weren't many, knew that there was a half-truth in almost everything Alan Church said.
This ends Disc 1.